It's showtime.
Kincaid, 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. Yes, indeed, this program is live. It's, about a minute past the hour. That'll be the final time check for the evening. Some habits die hard. It is the third day of October 2019. We're told here in the hills and hollers of almost level West by Cole, Trump, Virginia stand that this has been the last warm day. And the forecast looks like it, too. We got up into the 90s today, here in the fabulous Horn Studios at the magnificent Kincaid Mansion. It's 86 and a half degrees, so who knows, it may be the last day of you-know-what kind of radio until, you know, late spring of 2020. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. Like I said, this program is live. I'm really here. These 3 hours these days represent a sort of refuge, and we'll have 3 hours of cussing and discussing on this Thorn in the Side Thursday, and I think I've got some thorns set aside. Before we get started, every program here begins with gratitude, because you are the ones who keep it on the air, so thanks go out to Gene and Ann across the pond. Thanks go out to John and to Steven. And thanks go out to Janice. And tremendous thanks go out to Yuki and Peggy. Peggy in the sandbox. Thank you very kindly. Jumping in alongside an anonymous friend. Two anonymous friends. And our pal Shorty in L.A., making it possible for me to get out in front of some of the bills a little bit, so that if it turns out I'm not on the air at some point in the near future, that we will we'll be able to be okay. That having been said, thank you to our subscribers, and thank you, as mentioned, to Yuki and to two anonymous friends. Thank you to Shorty, and thank you to Peg in the sandbox. Thank you also to Jan and Jerry. They responded to Tracy's challenge for the evening. Remember, Tracy's challenge was the $50 in case of Bob's absence meat challenge. So we got $25 to go on that, which means that if met, we'll only have $100 to go to meet the fundraising goal for this evening, which is tremendous. And more than that, I cannot thank you all enough for your tremendous outpouring of support and compassion. The notes and the letters have been pouring in, and I'm beggared for words to let you all know how much it means, not just to Agnes and me, but to our son, and in this intractable, miserable situation. There's nothing new to report on the situation. It has not improved. I guess one can say it has not worsened. But it just remains the brutal fact that it is. and my heart feels like it's made of lead. Everyone that I've spoken to has recommended that for the time being, our son stay where he is, and that goes from, well, I'm not going to list off all the names, but it's everyone. And it's a terribly grief-inducing situation. And I'll let you know as things develop. What a world. And it's not just, you know, personally. It's what a world in regard to, God, why can't I get these levels any better? Okay, is that, yeah, hopefully that's a little bit better, but it damn sure doesn't look like much. I've had some notes about the audio levels, especially on the podcast, and so I've been messing around inside the sound settings, trying to make them a little bit better, and make the podcast a little bit less low volume-wise. Well, in the Eastern Seaboard, I guess that's going to be the way of things. Shit, Bob, says Darlene in Connecticut. Our last warm day in New England was yesterday, and it's been miserable here in Connecticut today. I heard the same thing from my buddy up in coastal Massachusetts, who nonetheless went out onto the beach today just to take the air and the scenery and the sound of the pounding surf, and said it had been just, it had suddenly gone frigid. Oh, let's see. It is Thorn in the Side Thursday. And I want to thank you for the opportunity for these 3 hours to sort of put things aside and focus on something, you know, focus on the broader world. It means a lot. By the way, you're welcome to jump into the chat room. Jimmy and Squeaky are already there and waiting for your arrival. Also, of course, capable moderator, longtime inveterate, indefatigable veteran chat room moderator Sparky, who today, third stage guild navigator that he is, has folded space to become Man Cave, and he's joined by his trusty companion, pinch hit midweek chat room utility moderator and all-around great guy, Steve from Georgistan. A wonderful time, I hope, will be had by all. But where to begin this evening with this Thorn in the Side Thursday? As you can imagine, laughs are hard to come by. So let's start with one, shall we? And what's funny, it's delightful. What we're going to have is the audio that was running live from Fox News TV Radio Rwanda at the exact moment when Jim Shorts Jordan, the man who turned his back on young men reporting that they had been raped, credibly accused of so doing, was joined by a couple of other goobers to discuss the Volker closed door testimony. And of course, well, I mean, you'll hear their take on it. It was, it's all so unfair. Adam Schiff is being so mean to us. When these same goons ran roughshod when they were in charge of the House of Representatives. They were fine with doling out sauce for the goose, but when the gander is getting fed it, they don't like it at all. No. What makes this funny is the way that it ends. Because today, doubling down, Nitwit Nero stood outside at the White House and was asked again the question that he was asked yesterday during the press conference with Finnish President Sauli Niinistö. He was asked the question again, what exactly was it that you wanted Ukraine to do in regard to Joe Biden and his son, Hunter? And, well, it didn't go so well, because with the cameras rolling live on the TV, Nitwit Nero doubled down and confessed his impeachability all over again. Because he said that he not only, in answering the question, he said, well, I wanted them to investigate Joe and Hunter Biden, and you know what? I want China to investigate, too. China needs to investigate. I mean, there's not any question over his criminality and his impeachability. But when they were standing there blathering in front of the cameras and microphones, Jim Shorts Jordan and his disloyal, un-American, Republican fellow Trump salad tossers, they didn't know that. They didn't know it had happened. They didn't know it, that is, until they did know it. Let's pick up the action about a minute and a half before the knowledge sets in.
This is how Mr. Schiff is going to conduct these type of interviews in the future. That's a concern as well. But Ambassador Volker has been very impressive, and as I said...
This, of course, is Jim Shorts Jordan, who refuses to wear a jacket in the Congress of the United States because the women folk get to wear pants. You know, at some point in time when this little bastard goes to work, he has to have the jacket on because that's how you get through security. I mean, I've run around the congressional office buildings enough and seen them go in and out, members of Congress. They got a little lapel button that they wear. And it immediately signals to Capitol Security, oh, that's a member, and he doesn't have to fool with the metal detector or any of that business. And they just loop him around, and he goes about his business. And, of course, once you get into one House office building, you can just use the tunnels under Rayburn and Longworth and Cannon to go from building to building if you need. But when you go in the building, you still got to get through security. And as long as that button's visible, beep, you're right in. Otherwise, you're digging out the wallet, and you take out the wallet and the cell phone, and you take out the wallet and the cell phone and your fountain pen, and the wallet and the cell phone and your fountain pen and your car keys. And it's a hassle, because that time of morning you're standing there in line and you just... But, right. So that, you know, that's one of the things that's kind of a tip-off about the vanity and shitheadedness of Jim Shorts Jordan. He has to wear the coat, because he damn sure doesn't have his little member of Congress button on his oh-so-ordinary dress shirt with the spread collar. Just, you know, little details like that leap out at me from time to time. And he's talking about Volker, and he doesn't want to give up anything, but he's terribly impressed with Volker, who, incidentally, is absolutely unwilling to take the fall for any of the monumental bullshit that has been blathered out there. He gave his testimony behind closed doors. We don't know what he said, but we get the general gist that he is, like I said, not going to take the fall. He's not going to be the patsy. And ABC News has gotten hold of some text messages that Kurt Volker turned over to Congress. And in one particular text exchange, a guy named Bill Taylor who was the number one U.S. diplomat to Ukraine, told a bunch of other American diplomats, quote, "I think it's crazy to withhold security assistance for help with a political campaign." What he was talking about was the fact that that military assistance to Ukraine was being used as a carrot dangling in front of Ukraine's nose in order for them to be willing to help Chlamydia Claudius in his effort to smear the guy that he is apparently terrified of facing in November of 2020. So Bill Taylor said, "I think it's crazy to withhold security assistance for help with a political campaign." Bill Taylor understood that this was all about trying to advance venereal Vespasian's 2020 reelection effort. Enter a guy named Gordon Sondland. Now, he's the U.S. ambassador to the EU. Why, you might ask, is Gordon Sondland the U.S. ambassador to the EU? Well, he gave a horse-gagging amount of money to the Trump Inaugural Committee. You remember the Inaugural Committee, the one that's still under investigation, that was a complete exercise in graft and corruption. Yeah, that one. He gave over $1 million to the Inaugural Committee. And the next thing you know, Gordon Sondland's being told that, well, by Jove, he's going to be the ambassador to the EU. Well, Gordon Sondland got in on that text exchange, the one where Bill Taylor said, "I think it's crazy to withhold security assistance for help with a political campaign." And the next thing you know, he's tweeting back, "Ixnay on the idque, opre, oque." No, he didn't say that, you know, before some fucking Republican congressman says,
that Bob Kincaid is falsely quoting a good man like Gordon Sondland, who never said ixnay on the idque, opre, oque. I don't even know what ixnay on the idque, opre, oque means. I don't speak a foreign language.
But Sondland said, "Hey, there was no quid pro quo. Quit talking about this on these text messages." Hence, ixnay on the idque, opre, oque. Because everybody understood that that's exactly what it is. Not that it's legally required, mind you. The mere intent is enough to support both an impeachment and a conviction. It's also enough to support a criminal charge and a conviction, if only we weren't still operating under that deeply un-American and misguided so-called guidance from the Office of Legal Counsel that says the President of the United States could gun down people in Lafayette Square Park while being observed by an entire legion of Secret Service officers, FBI agents, FBI law enforcement officers, the Metro D.C. police, and the Capitol police. And even though they had all witnessed those murders take place, none of them could touch him because as president, he's above the fucking law. That guidance. So Gordon Sondland, who had quid pro quoed his way into the job of ambassador to the EU, told Bill Taylor to up about the thing. I mean, we'll call it the thing, but, you know, it's where we're withholding aid to get some dirty dealing by the Ukrainians in support of Trump's presidential reelection. The thing. Right. So that's one of the things that was taking place, or had taken place, by the time that Jim Shorts Jordan was proudly declaiming into the cameras and the microphones there outside the hearing, while other good loyal Trump salad tossers were standing by. Let's get back to the action, because this is funny.
I said nothing that nothing that coincides with what the Democrats are saying with their whole impeachment narrative.
The question is, has Volkert testified to evidence that
We're not going to get into specifics.
Has what he said this morning either backed up or conflicted with the allegations in the complaint?
Nothing he has said supports the
It says supports. That's the word we're looking for there. Supports, Jim Shorts. Supports. Nothing supports the allegations in the complaint. Harumph! Of course, we kind of have to take their word for that, don't we? Not exactly big truth tellers, those three.
The narrative you've been hearing from Mr. Schiff and the Democrats, nothing. And it's been, but I tell you what, I think we've all been very impressed with Mr. Volcker and his...
Oh, gosh, yes, we're terribly impressed with Mr. Volcker. There's nothing in what he said that backs up the whistleblower complaint. God, no. I mean, you know what? There's nothing there. There's nothing in the whistleblower complaint. I mean, it's not like the President of the United States stood in the Rose Garden or anything and admitted to trying to strong-arm Ukraine or called on China to investigate Biden, too.
Knowledge of the subject.
Did he reveal any conversations that he had with the president himself?
We're not going to get into details until the whole interview is done. But some of us have to go.
Does any of it contradict what the Democrats have said?
What is the counter narrative? You say that this is not the narrative that the Democrats.
We'll get to that when we're done with the interview. We just want to come out and give you.
We haven't made it up yet.
Heads up on what we see happening.
Concerns about what the president said on the South Lawn this week. China and Ukraine should investigate the Bidens.
We've been.
You got the question right. Do you have any concerns about what the president said today on the South Lawn about how Ukraine and China should investigate the Bidens? Got any concerns about that, Jim Shorts? And it was all new to Jim Shorts. And it was as though he were standing smack dab below the castle in Monty Python and the Holy Grail when they heard the chickens cackle and the loud moo and the springs of the catapult, and they looked up and then doing his best King Arthur, Jim Shorts Jordan says, "Run away!"
Do you have any concerns about what the president said on the South Lawn this week? Ukraine should investigate the Bidens.
We've been in the interview for 2 hours.
China and Ukraine.
Mana, we don't know what the president said there. We haven't looked at it.
Was there any discussion of the aid and why it was
made? He's done for the day?
No.
I'm sorry, you're waiting for another round.
Thank you. Goodbye. I hear my mom calling. I got to get my hair done. Oh, God, the dog ate it. Like I said, we need a little humor. There's nothing funnier than watching Jim Shorts Jordan run away when he finds out that the President of the United States has admitted on live television in front of the whole wide world to impeachable offenses while standing on the grounds of his own White House. Yay! Mm-hmm. So there was that. And that was a funny thing. Very funny indeed. And, of course, now we're finding out via the Wall Street Journal today. I don't know if these are thorns in our side or thorns in Tangerine Tiberius, as this is. But today, according to the Wall Street Journal, the reason that the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch, was recalled was because Rudy Giuliani went to him pissing and moaning. We don't know if he was sober when he did it. That Marie Yovanovitch wasn't doing enough to help him shake down the Ukrainian government on behalf of Trump. The Wall Street Journal story says that Giuliani reminded the president of complaints percolating among Trump supporters that she had displayed an anti-Trump bias in private conversations. In Mr. Giuliani's view, she also had been an obstacle to efforts to push Ukraine to investigate Mr. Biden and his son, Hunter. Oh, enjoy prison, Rudy. And enjoy bringing down the Trump presidency. Because even if he's not removed from office subsequent to impeachment, it will mark Well, the low point, the nadir of the Trump presidency, and he may or may not survive. I don't mean existentially, but politically survive it. Yeah. I mean, that's a great reason for not... Both of them. Those are just both awesome reasons. I mean, can you imagine if the Wall Street Journal had published a story saying that Barack Obama had shit-canned a U.S. ambassador after word got back to him from a lawyer saying that that ambassador was not sufficiently obsequious to Obama? The howls would and the shrieks and the screams from Fox News and all their various and sundry fellow travelers and co-conspirators would still be ringing the earth and audible even in the vast vacuum of space itself. Brother Deacon Asa asked, was Rudy in drag when he went preening to the Tangerine Tiberius? I'm asking for some friends. You got some friends, Brother Deacon Asa. You do. So that's how Marie Yovanovitch came to not have an ambassadoring job anymore. A note coming in from Darlene in Connecticut. The Republican goons are all on message. The C-SPAN all-day stakeout is still ongoing, and just one Republican emerged and said Volker has blown a hole in the accusation that Trump asked Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky to dig up dirt on Joe and Hunter Biden. Dig up dirt? I don't recall that being the accusation. The gaggle finally caught on to the sleight of mouth and questioned the little GOP dweeb about it, but only after he had many minutes to spew his talking points. Everything you're describing that Jim Short spewed, this younger GOP dweeb did as well. It's pretty exact. The dweeb was thrown by the gaggle, asking him about Trump's impeachable comments today. But, oh, he's been in the skiff all day, so he couldn't comment on that. I don't know anything about it, never heard of it. We'll probably have a press release that says it didn't even happen, and that was a made-up, somebody in a Trump suit that Adam Schiff sent out there to say that. It didn't happen. Now, closed hearings are being called SCIF, Sensitive Classified Information Facility. Yeah, that's where members of the House had to go when they wanted to see the Mueller report, because it was on double-secret probation. Says Darlene, wondering if that was not by accident, trying to correlate what Adam Schiff and the Democrats are doing with closed-door hearings with what Trump officials did with transferring Trump's phone call transcripts to the top-secret IC server. Hey, same difference, right? So, you know, that's not impeachable either. This is sick and twisted right down to the details. That from Darlene in Connecticut. Citing our buddy Michael in Madison with the subject line hysterical, Flavio passes along what Michael said. Trump just whistle blew himself, which is actually quite impressive. According to legend, Marilyn Manson had to have ribs removed to perform that feat. Oh, yeah, you earned that one, Michael in Madison. Marilyn Manson had to have ribs removed to perform that feat. Note coming in from Matt in San Francisco. As an experienced drag queen, I object. What Rudy was in was not drag. It was simply a drag to witness. Well played, Matt. Well played. And, you know, not to try to dig for information, but if you'd care to share it, what is your drag name? Drag names are everything, aren't they? If you feel like sharing that, I still remember that was a fabulous, and I do mean fabulous, photo that you sent along of you and your husband. Y'all are good at that. Very good. So I thought the program should start with a little bit of humor, because watching Watching maggots squirm is always a delight. It is as though some sort of political or philosophical salt has been tossed their way. Yeah. But I want to get into something else, because earlier today, Paul Krugman, Nobel Prize-winning economist Paul Krugman, who gets a lot of stuff right, is being praised for having gotten something else right. But I'm not sure he did. One of the biggest parlor games of the multimillionaire for-profit media these days is to ponder the question, why, oh why, sweet fake baby Jeebus, will Republicans, none of them, speak up about the obvious crimes of Donald Trump? And in particular, none of them in the Senate. I mean, goodness sakes, Jeff Flake, that man of towering ethics and courage and a quiver full of rubber-tipped arrows, who occasionally tepidly criticized Donald Trump, but every time he was called on to vote for crap that Trump wanted, said, yes, sir, please, may I have another. Suggesting a drag queen name for Rudy Giuliani, Lee in New York suggests Rude Appalling. I like that. Ah, there we go. Yes, yes. Okay. Jezebel Collingwood. By God, you got to appreciate a good usage of Jezebel. Collingwood, says Matt, is one street up from Castro, and back in the day before Grindr, after the bars closed, many would cruise around that circle looking for a good time. Jezebel Collingwood. Well done. Well done, Matt. So, anyway, this business of playing the parlor game of why will no Republicans speak up against Trump's obvious malfeasance in office, his high crimes and misdemeanors, if you will, his impeachable attempt, if you will, to bribe the president of Ukraine into participating with him in a dirty scheme to try to smear a political opponent. Why? Why won't they do that? Well, in a series of tweets today, Paul Krugman, again, no slouch as an economist and pretty good at the whole thinking things through business, offered up a theory. And on its face, it's not that shabby a theory. But you know how it is with me and with literature. I saw the series of tweets, and I immediately got to thinking about who? Well, of course, Mary Shelley. Because, well, who doesn't read Paul Krugman's tweets about Trump and Republicans and not think of Mary Shelley? Well, everybody but me. But then again, that's what this little community is for. Mary Shelley was a brilliant young woman of the 19th century, and she and some of her wealthy friends took a little vacation. Maybe they were in Switzerland or something. I can't remember. But they all set about to write a story. And the next thing you know, in those days when you actually had to use quill pens and scratch on parchment and shit like that, I mean, do you know how thick the original Frankenstein by Mary Shelley is? It's not a pamphlet. But she came up with Frankenstein. And of course, it is in Hollywood, it would be turned into this fire bad monster movie, which would later give birth to the brilliant Young Frankenstein. Come back. I was going to make espresso. But the book itself is far more than simply the monster. It is about the limits of science, the intersection of ethics and science, of course, being a young and burgeoning field at the time. By the way, Megan says, I know why Republicans won't speak up against Trump's offenses. It's because they're all sucking milk off Putin's teat. Well, maybe this is all intersectional. Maybe everything is right at the same time. Maybe it's different strokes for, yeah, right. But that's not where I'm going. Back to Frankenstein. The whole idea is that after Dr. Frankenstein creates the creature, and succeeds in that greatest of all human ambitions, the reanimation of dead tissue, creating the creature. You know the story, basically. The creature runs amok. And in the book, the creature is really quite sympathetic. But because he has been created by human effort, eventually, after he is sufficiently tormented, the creature turns on his creator. Now, there are entire graduate-level seminar master's theses and PhD dissertations that have been defended on this particular topic. But the long and the short of it is that the creature eventually turns on his maker. And so while Paul Krugman suggested, and I'm just reading along here, so all the pundits who warned that Dems were making a terrible mistake are engaged in some serious soul-searching, right? Ha 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 ha. Noting support among the American people for impeachment is going up and up and up, which curiously is absolutely unlike the support for impeachment under the Republicans against Bill Clinton, in which they could never get majority support for impeaching Bill Clinton. And Krugman followed and said, actually, a real puzzle. Why are so many center-right anti-Trumpers deeply opposed to holding Trump accountable for abuse of power? You might think they'd be glad to see him fall because of his personal sins, not his policies. And then he announces, Krugman does, his thesis. One answer might be Pelosi derangement syndrome. They may be anti-Trump, but can't stand admitting that Dems are doing anything right. Strong overlap between never impeachers and those who insisted Dems were blowing the midterms. All this is, of course, a minor sideshow. Much more important to ask whether any Republican senators will relocate their spines. Experience isn't encouraging, but hope springs eternal. Now, far be it from me to just come out and say, hey, the Nobel Prize-winning economist who works for the New York Times and thinks deeply about many things is wrong. But while that may be an element of it, I don't think it sufficiently addresses the entire field. I think my theory addresses the entire field. And you can, if you wish, consider my theory, the Frankenstein theory. Going back over two generations, the Republican Party, with some connivance of alleged Democrats, I think, for instance, to 1968 and George Wallace's independent presidential candidacy, in which he was going to send a message to Washington, and talked about how, and Nixon's theory of the silent majority. Well, they have all been whipped up into a white, and I do mean white hot frenzy, since about 1968. Matters of resentment, matters of racism, ethnocentrism, bigotry. Those are all the base, and I don't mean at level, I mean base as in foul. Those are all the base impulses that, along with fear and hatred, that have driven Republican political campaigns, actually probably since 1964, when Barry Goldwater was saying that it was okay to launch the occasional nuke. I know. Flavio says, don't forget, Krugman works for the for-profit New York Times. While I will read his stuff every now and then, I always read his stuff with a truckload of salt. I also remember he mercilessly went after Bernie Sanders and Medicare for All. Come on, Krugman. Every other advanced democracy has universal health care decoupled from one's work. But I still read his stuff, says Flavio, but with eyes wide open. Well, this is where my Frankenstein theory comes in. The Republican Party, in this theory, plays the role of Dr. Frankenstein. Brother Deacon Asa says, if you're suggesting that Republicans don't rat on Trump because he's a creature of their own making, let me be the first to disabuse you of that notion. Anything pigs create will simply fall apart like a bunch of broccoli. True enough, Brother Deacon Asa, under most circumstances. But work with me here. Beginning around 1970, recognizing an opportunity when they saw one, the Republicans began, and do so unto this day, to use fear to motivate their voting base. And fear leads to, well, it's to go after another book, fear is the mind killer. Fear is the little death that leads to total oblivion. Now, in the litany against fear, the Bene Gesserit litany against fear from Dune, it continues, I will face my fear. I will allow it to pass over me and through me. And when it is gone, only I will remain. But Republicans don't know anything about the litany against fear. Republican what should we call them? Republican fear pimps, however, know that that it'll drive a shit ton of people to the polls. And in creating this monster, they have armed the monster. The monster is, of course, the average Republican white voter. And in the years since 1970, when the National Rifle Association went from a marksmanship and hunting group to a militant, weaponized political pressure campaign, more and more people have taken up firearms. We can see the effect of that in the almost daily bloodlettings that we experience in this country. And so they got their wish. Republicans hammered and beat and thumped and drummed and went hammer and tongs on the idea that everybody had to have a gun. And probably lots of guns, because the government was going to come for your guns. You know, obviously missing the point that if you don't have any guns for the government to come for, the government's probably not going to come to your house. I know. Logic's not their strong suit. But they have created an America in 2019 that is bristling with firearms. And owned by people who are more than willing and actually fantasize about the day that they get to use them. And that is the Frankenstein's monster that has come after the doctor. As far back as the Obama administration, they were rallying and carrying posters that said, It was during the campaign of Scott Brown for Senate in Massachusetts when the teabaggers showed up with their tri-cornered hats carrying signs that said, "If Brown can't do it, Browning can." Browning being a world-famous manufacturer of firearms. And creator of the iconic Browning automatic rifle. You might recall, just as a historical side note, that Bonnie and Clyde ran around with Thompson submachine guns, you know, the ones with the drums, you know, the violin case, all that shit. And the law enforcement folks who ambushed and massacred them, well, they weren't fooling around with any Thompson submachine guns. They loaded up with Browning automatic rifles, machine guns of their own right, and chewed Bonnie and Clyde and their gang to pieces with them. If Brown can't do it, Browning can. And God, that's what, 2009? Trump, on the hustings in 2016, suggested that Republicans should use their Second Amendment remedies against Hillary Clinton. A clear call for a stochastic terroristic call for one of them to assassinate her. And it's only gotten worse since. I mean, even here in West Virginia, where Joe Manchin, who's not exactly some sort of pinko commie, anti-gun, sissy liberal, Joe Manchin, who suggested closing the background check loophole for gun shows, to this day, if I go to various sites, I'll say, "Tell Joe Manchin to keep his goddamn hands off our guns." And in that reality lies the true answer to why none of these Republicans will stand up and support impeaching and removing the President of the United States from office. Because if there is any truth in Jeff Flake and that other individual who said that if the ballot were taken in secret in the Senate, that 30 to 35 Republican senators would vote to remove Trump from office. Well, forgive me, Dr. Krugman, but that doesn't have anything to do with Nancy Pelosi. That has everything to do with the gut-level recognition of Republicans that the monster that they created is out of control. Just because they holler mental health every time some bloodbath is unleashed, every time the NRA's roulette wheel of death and misery lands on another random community, just because they do that doesn't mean that they don't understand the sickness that this country suffers with firearms. I would suggest that they know it better than anyone else, because they are more afraid than anyone else of the very people who keep them in office. And if Donald Trump will call openly for the execution of the whistleblower and Adam Schiff by referring to treason, and like I said, make no mistake, when the maggots hear treason, they know it means kill. Then people like Republican senators and Republicans in the House know that they had best keep their mouths fucking shut. Or that if they choose to open them, the only way they should open them is if, in fact, they are tossing Trump's salad. And so consequently, Republicans know that the monster is loose. And they know that, like the villagers in Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, they have tormented the monster and driven it into paroxysms of pure animal rage. And that if they uphold their oaths to the Constitution, that they will become the immediate recipients and targets of that pure animal rage of the monster that they themselves created. And that it will be hell on them. Because the maggots may hate Democrats. The maggots do hate Democrats. And they probably, in their most private thoughts, would like to do something bloody. I mean, after all, we did have a guy mailing bombs to people he perceived to be enemies of Trump a year or so ago. So there's that. But just as Dante, in his Inferno, reserved the lowest level of hell for the betrayers, well, Dante was tapping into a sort of a universal sentiment when he did that. And for any Republican who dared to vote against Donald Trump in an impeachment proceeding or in a trial in the Senate, the white, and I do mean white, hot fury of the maggots would be amplified the way the energy of a star getting ready to go nova amplifies. The heat would expand and become all-encompassing. And so, with due respect to Dr. Krugman, I do think he's wrong. There's nothing so cerebral as Pelosi derangement syndrome that motivates these people. Some of them simply are on board and fully signed on to the racism and bigotry, the homophobia, the nationalism that Trump espouses. But any of them who have misgivings, well, those people know that they already have a gun. And not really a gun, but millions of guns to their heads. Because the maggots won't come for the Democrats first. They will come first for anyone that they deem to have betrayed their God Emperor. Just as the creature came finally for his creator. Funny how these things just sort of rattle around my mind. Flavio says, very compelling theory. Can it also coexist with the possibility the Russians have so much compromise against the repugnance that they dare not get out of line? I mean, so many of them went to Mother Russia. Seven. It was seven, wasn't it? Seven Republican senators. And there's still the question of what was on the RNC server. If you were Pooty, and you got all that sweet, sweet compromise on Republicans, and you knew you would never have leverage over Democrats, you'd use the material you had against the Democrats, lickety-split. But you'd keep that Republican compromise tucked close to your heart, in your breast pocket, where you could get at it any time you wanted. There's a story, possibly real, possibly apocryphal, about the Kennedy presidency. J. Edgar Hoover was despised by every president because J. Edgar Hoover, first and foremost, made sure that J. Edgar Hoover was safe. The man had spent a lifetime passing and knew that it would all fall apart if that and his sexuality were to come out. And that was, and so he used the FBI as his own personal blackmail and extortion squad. And the story goes that Kennedy said he wanted to get rid of J. Edgar Hoover, and that in no time flat, he was having a meeting with his FBI director. Who opened a manila folder and showed John Kennedy some photographs. And said, don't worry, Mr. President. I'll keep these locked up safe. And the talk of getting rid of J. Edgar Hoover dried right up. Compromise. Compromise. it's not just for Russians. But things like the inexplicable behavior of Lindsey Graham, and I'm not one of those people who say, well, you know, he certainly was a decent soul when he was John McCain's friend, because I remember far too well the heady days of the Clinton impeachment and trial, those early months of 1999, when our family was still so young, and I was, well, I wasn't back to doing this yet, but I followed it day in and day out, because it was a level of political spectacle that I'd only witnessed as a child during the Watergate hearings. So, Lindsey Graham is not a paragon of virtue. He was a crass, mush-mouthed political hack in 1999, and he has been one every day of his life since. But what he has become since the advent of Trump is almost unexplainable unless you go for the kompromat theory or the fact that he is a senator in the most obstreperous state in the Union, a state known for being prone to shooting at people when it doesn't get its way. This would be the second straight night with a reference to Fort Sumter. And so Lindsey, who has been propped up by the NRA with the benefit and the beneficiary of wads and wads and wads of sweet, sweet, sweet National Ruble Association money. Lindsey probably understands that what I guess we will refer to going forward as the Frankenstein factor better than most. But look at the other senators and where they come from. McConnell and Rand Paul, Kentucky. Lindsey Graham and Tim Scott in South Carolina. Richard Burr and Thom Tillis in North Carolina. Whoever the goobers are in Mississippi. Richard Shelby in Alabama. The one seat that's not empty, Purdue in Georgia. Lamar Alexander, who should be immune to any of this, but is retiring in Tennessee. Marsha, goodness, Blackburn in Tennessee as well, one of whose dear friends and campaign cronies was also up to his eyeballs in advancing the NRA's interests in Mother Russia. It goes on and on and on. Arkansas. Rafaelito Eduardo Cruz, the anointed booger-eating future king of America, and John Cornhole in Texas. John Kennedy and whoever the other one is in Louisiana. Look down the list of the entire Republican caucus in the Senate, and you'll see people who come from intensely gunned up places. Susan Collins of Maine, where they got a shit ton of guns. Ron Johnson in Wisconsin, where hunting is as close to sacred as the baby Christ's mouth is to Mother Mary's nipple. Montana, Wyoming,
Utah, Idaho, Kansas, Indiana. These are all states, Missouri. These are all states that are absolutely filthy with firearms.
And when you look at it that way, it's, I mean, I think my argument is compelling. In fact, I think it's downright Sherlock Holmesian. When you have eliminated the impossible, whatever is left, no matter how improbable, is the answer. And the answer to Republican fear is not that they're afraid of maggots at the ballot box, but of maggots at the ammunition box. What do you think? Megan says, I would have thought that after Steve Scalise got shot and was subsequently saved by Capitol Police, the Republicans would have known that particular fire would get their hands burned, too. Alas, they seem to have developed amnesia. They didn't develop amnesia, Megan. They doubled down. Because the Steve Scalise shooting had the benefit of being perpetrated by a non-maggot. A guy infuriated about health care. A guy who we were repeatedly hammered by the multimillionaire for-profit media as being a Bernie supporter. So there didn't have to be any learning curve there. Yeah. Lee in New York says, fear is the path to the dark side. Oh, wait, no.
Fear is the path to the dark side. Fear leads to anger. Anger leads to hate. Hate leads to suffering.
It's the best I can do on a short notice for a Yoda. Thank you, Lee. So we can certainly talk about that if you'd like to. The stress line's open, 844-843-4676, 844-THE-HORN. Last I checked, it was still connected to the Bluetooth. Let me look again. Bluetooth on. No, hell no, it's not connected. But it will be. It will be. So if you want to discuss that or anything else, you're mighty welcome to. By the way, just a reminder, we haven't had the Green News Report in quite some time. And that is because Brad Friedman's father passed away. And so as soon as they're back from that, they'll be back, and we send our sincerest condolences to Brad and his family in the time of their grief. Last I heard, Brad was sitting Shiva. And so, as the saying goes, may his father's memory be for a blessing. But I feel like we've hit some real high points in the first hour here, the filibobster. Remember, Tracy's in case of Bob's absence, pull challenge. Challenges on the table. $25 of it got met by Jan and Jerry. The other 25 remains to be met, and that'll leave only 100 to go to finish the evening. And I'm not trying to make it anything it isn't, but I'm just saying that we need to keep up with fundraising, because I don't know from one day to the next when the program's going to be on because of things that are well, the situation that presently obtains here. It was a couple of days ago. I hate to break it to you, Bob, says Darlene in Connecticut, but your Yoda sounds more like Kermit the Frog.
Kermit the Frog. Sesame Street News.
There's a reason for that, Darlene. Yoda and Kermit were the same guy. But there was a shade of difference. But when my Yoda usually does come out Kermit the Frog. Note coming in from Kyle. Pelosi derangement syndrome is extremely real. Several times a day, my maggot father will start screaming at his TV while watching fascist news about how Pelosi needs to be kicked out of the office. He never complains about her policies, only going into personal attacks on her. They're all scared shitless of her because she's a powerful woman, and they know she will take down Trump, and they can't accept that. Oh, goody. Kyle adds, ha, 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 ha. All the one-liners and impersonations tonight have made me shoot water out my nose. Thanks, Bob. Well, I'm glad it's water, Kyle, because, you know, if it's Sprite or ginger ale or Coca-Cola, that or beer, that shit burns. Truly. Breaking news out of the New York Times, it just gets worse. U.S. diplomats drafted a statement for Ukraine's leader, and that would be Zelensky, I presume, that would have committed him to investigations of nitwit Nero's rivals. The drafting of the statement marks new evidence of how Mr. Trump's fixation with Ukraine began driving senior diplomats to bend American foreign policy to the president's political agenda in the weeks after the July 25th call between the two leaders. You know, we can say this much, because we know it as being fact. If an African-American president had done any of this, he would have been removed from office, and there would have been no question of it. Even Democrats in the Senate probably would have voted to convict one of their own. But we're like that. Oaths matter. And to dishonor an oath is to dishonor oneself. But where Republicans are concerned, there is no honor. There is nothing, nothing but the unending grasp of Republicans for political power. So a few days ago, Nitwit Nero was in the business of putting together what was called an executive order to stop, and this is the socialist destruction of Medicare. No, really. The socialist destruction of a socialist program. It was unveiled today during a trip to Florida, and he was trying to push back against the idea of everybody getting Medicare. This, of course, after the Trump administration itself has his budget has slashed the living bejesus out of Medicare. And the irony of saving a socialist program from socialism being utterly lost on a group of people with a collective IQ of a drowning flea. So today, well, it happened. It got rolled out. And he tried to, what Nero did, he tried to make a funny. But you can't make funny when you don't know how to laugh. And the only thing you've ever found funny is hurting other people. So he went to Florida and wound up going off on another one of his tirades. But in the midst of it, this.
But I'm pretty sure you're going to do fantastically, Ron. You feel good about it? Huh? You better do good. Otherwise, you're making us both look bad. You hear that, Casey? American patients must no longer be forced to subsidize lower drug prices in other countries through higher prices in America. That's what we were doing. We're paying a much higher price. My administration will never stop fighting for lower costs for American patients and American seniors. The third part of our health care vision is to provide the choice and control Americans want. We eliminated Obamacare's horrible, very expensive and very unfair,
horrible.
Unpopular individual mandate, a total disaster. That was a big penalty. That was a big thing. Well, you paid a lot of money for the privilege of not having to pay a lot of money for the privilege of having no health care. You paid not to have health care. It was a penalty. And how it ever held up in Supreme Court, I don't know, but it did.
There's that. There's his mother's accent again. I don't know. I don't know. I do. I don't know.
But we just got rid of it. We just did it the old-fashioned way. We got rid of it. We vastly expanded affordable insurance options, including association health plans, short-term plans, and health reimbursement arrangements, which are incredible. And many of these...
And he's right. They are incredible. Credo, credere, credi, creditum, Latin, to believe... To be incredible is to be not believable, and none of this is believable. So, you know, I guess points.
Options are up to 60% less expensive than Obamacare. Nobody got that. Nobody got that. That's okay. Obamacare. I didn't say Obamacare. I said Obamacare.
He's wasted. Nobody got that. Nobody.
President Obamacare, he can have it. But we've done a great job in running it. We almost had it done. We unfortunately had one vote. Middle of the night, just went thumbs down. That wasn't good. After years and years of campaigning, repeal and replace, right? But we've done a great job because we got rid of the individual mandate and we're running it better. It's still no good because it's too expensive. The premium is way too high and all of the elements of it, it's just not good. But we're coming up with an incredible plan that if the Republicans take back the House, keep the Senate, keep the presidency, we're going to have a fantastic day.
Yeah, cheer you, maggots. The last time it sounded like, he made his funny and nobody laughed.
I think we should charge them, the people who didn't laugh, with treason. We need to look into them for treason. They didn't laugh. Jesus.
Oh, and by the way, in the middle of the news story, I'm looking at this. There's an ad. Sign now if you think Adam Schiff should step down. I don't know if you saw the story, but the Republican war chest is flush. An appropriate word, too, because between now and November 2020, you're going to wish that you could flush every network that runs these ads, every social media platform that runs these ads, every website that runs these ads, right down the shitter. and it's going to be everywhere. And a little critique along the way. I happened to catch a little bit of MSNBC today when Katie Turr was talking with somebody, John Harwood of CNBC, about the Wall Street investment bankers and hedge fund managers who are saying that they're willing to support Trump to keep Elizabeth Warren out of the White House. It was some seriously bullshit reporting, if you could call it reporting at all. Because you don't need to say who those people are without telling us what their names are. Because these are people with horse-gagging loads of money who get it by, you know, doing business. And we need to know who the businesses are so that we can make sure that the businesses don't get our dollars. Yeah, they talked about how, Elizabeth Warren's wealth tax may be impossible to implement. And yet somehow or another they managed not to say that the fact of the matter is, you know, those same, and they were said to be wealthy Democratic donors. Well, they're not very Democratic. And we rather badly need to let folks know how we feel about people who stand up against or who stand up first and foremost for the wealthiest among us while telling the rest of us to go take a fly and fuck at a rolling donut. Thank you, by the way. Thanks here at almost the halfway mark of the program. Thank you to Vincent, and thank you to Renee. Vincent and Renee have finished off Tracy's in case of emergency pull challenge. So that means that now we have only $95 to finish for the evening. And all my sincere thanks to those of you who have made it possible for us to deal with some rather brutal contingencies. Thank you. So the filibobster has been rather broad and extensive. Let's go over and check in. Let's go over and check in with Scott and see which neurons I have agitated. Hey, Scott. Okay, that's either me. Hold on. Okay, I hear chirps.
Okay. Yeah, my neurons are born.
Hold on. Try me again.
My neurons.
Yeah, okay. I don't know if it's me or you. You want to try this? You want to try the stress line, Scott?
Is that the toll free?
Yeah.
All right, let me hang up and give it a try.
Okay, thanks. That was weird. Haven't had that problem in a while. I don't know if that was Scott. I don't know if that was Scott or me. So we'll hopefully find out. Okay. Oh, really? We're going to do this? Okay. Are you there, Scott?
Yes, I are here, Bob.
Okay, much better.
Okay, good. I'll only keep you a wee bit. I say that all the time, but maybe it's true this time. You never know. You have to believe. You know, you got to believe. All right. At the risk of making this sound like the start of a dirty phone call, can you guess what I've got in my hand, Bob?
At the risk of, I'm not going to cooperate because I'm betting you have a real live, honest to goodness, delicious cup of River Moon Keep It Lit Blend Coffee.
Correctamundo. Let me take a sip. Ah, that's great coffee.
And it is ever so much. Anyway. It is ever so much better than freeze dried, is it not?
Different. I've been on the freeze dried so long. I don't know what the good stuff is like. So I've got to.
We got to give a chance for your
reacclimate. Yeah,
your palate's got to get a chance to rehabilitate.
Yeah, and the other thing, the other day I set up the coffee maker and stuff. But I didn't have, the coffee maker, by the way, was a gift from an anonymous benefactor. And again, I tip the old rabbit ears to he or she for that kindness. But anyway, I didn't have filters and I didn't want to do the paper towel thing. I wanted it to be an authentic first try of the thing. And the Malloy blend is a dark roast. And while I was at the store last night, I figured, well, just to be safe, since my palate and memory are so, all of this is so foreign to me today, that I got a bag of a store brand of a medium roast called Breakfast Blend, and maybe I could mix and match or whatever, you know. Are you dancing?
No.
Or is...
No, that was over on your end.
Oh, well, that's weird, because I'm just sitting here as still as
sounded
as,
like sounded like maybe Chirps was, you know, scratching or something.
No, but be that as it may. So anyway, I got the coffee filters last night. So today was the inaugural usage of the test flight of the coffee maker. Now, it, by the way, is a 4-cup coffee maker. I don't know what kind of cups the Mr. Coffee test kitchen used.
Technically, it is a 6-ounce cup.
Well, Jesus, they did not envision my coffee mug.
So when they say basically 1 level tablespoon of coffee grounds per 6 ounces.
Yeah, well, and that's the other thing. When I would make the freeze dried, I would make it deliberately stronger than the label instructions. So I'm going to have to tinker with, you know, I may have to do a 4-tablespoon dose and maybe 4.5, you know, until I figure out which one works best.
Yeah, in a drip machine, all you want to do is make sure that the water doesn't overtop the filter, because then you get then you get grounds for termination.
Yeah. But, I see what you did there, Bob. But anyway, I'm mucho apreciado of the gift, and I will make good use of it. And I won't say that my freeze dried days are behind me, but I'll have that in store in case, you know, toward the end of the month I can't afford the good stuff. I've got to, you know, I can't sniff airplane glue, so I'll have to sniff Elmer's glue all.
Yeah, right.
Which it's not the same, you know.
You can always take 1 granule of freeze dried, and just tuck it under your tongue.
Oh, there's a thought. Sublingual dosage.
Yes. Right.
There you go. You're a smart, smart man, Mr. Goff.
Shh, don't tell him.
Okay. Yeah, and it occurred to me, and I don't want to go down this path because that's not really why I called, but it occurred to me that in recent days, Trump has been engaging with the help of Mr. Pompeo, the so-called Secretary of State. Jesus. Yeah, he gives you an idea what state we're in. But he's, Trump and company have been engaging, with the help of Mr. Pompeo, in sort of a where's Waldo approach to national security. You can't keep track of the guy. You know, you can't hardly count the stickers on his steamer trunk. All the places he's going, trying to enlist heads of governments to do investigations on Biden. Did I get that right? It's a where's Waldo kind of approach?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's anybody who will listen. And, of course, the one person doing the most listening is sweet, lovable, huggable, cuddleable Pootie.
Yeah. So this will prove to be quite an interesting thing to watch, and I'm sure we will be doing it. But anyway, the main purpose of the call, Bob, to get serious, and I don't mean to rehash trials and travails from yesterday. In listening to the program, you know, when your heart breaks, our heart breaks. I think we can agree on that.
Thank you.
And, you know, I tend to give advice only to people who are happier than I am, which I think you are when it comes right down to it. It's not hard to be happier than me, you know? But, you know, I know advice, as well-meaning as it could ever be, sometimes is not useful. But instead of advice, let's call it the wisdom of my own experience. Your mileage may vary, okay?
All right.
Let me take you back to the late 60s, when I was in seventh grade or thereabouts, okay? I was a troubled young man. I was the second oldest of four children in a middle-class, blue-collar family, growing up on the outskirts of Washington, D.C. in the scintillating 60s. The 60s were a traumatic decade, to be sure. I was raised and, you know, educated in Catholic grade schools. I don't know that my family was ultra-conservative, but they certainly weren't liberals. If anything, they were rightward-leaning moderates at best. But then you have the element of the Catholic Church as constituted in the 60s, post-Vatican II, but still kind of stuck in ancient, misty strangeness, okay? So you had the church influence, you had the parental influence, you had the society at large influence, and you had the Catholic education with the nuns influence. And it's hard enough to be in seventh grade, you know, without all that other extraneous crap. But nonetheless, there I was. I was a troubled kid, okay? And I don't think I've ever told this story publicly, or if I did, I alluded to it many, many moons ago, but I'm going to do it with the hope that something good will come of it, you know? At least wisdom or understanding or something. There was some real trouble going on at this point, and I somehow managed to discover, squirreled away in a downstairs dresser drawer, in the downstairs bathroom, a couple of old pistols that my dad had with little boxes of ammunition. And I somehow got it in my little troubled head that if things got bad enough, I'd blow some people away. Now, obviously, I never did, okay?
Right.
But believe me, the possibility of that scenario was closer than anybody will ever know. Well, as it turned out, I didn't. As it turned out, the discovery of my having access to these items of destruction got me into a weekly group counseling session there in my hometown. And I was in that for a couple of years, and there was some help to be had from it. In stories like this, you don't like to compare yourself to other people, But one of the kids in the group, his dad was like a Commonwealth attorney. That's sort of like a county level DA.
Yeah, prosecuting okay? attorney.
Yeah. One of the other kids' dads was the head of an Episcopal seminary. Okay. That kid, by the way, a couple of years later, hooked up with a father and son team of radicals, robbed a bank in Arlington, Crystal City. I can show you where it was if we're ever there together. Shot and killed a policeman. Went to Houston, I think. Hijacked a plane to Cuba, all three of them. And that was a hairy situation. So I know comparison will only take you so far. But all in all, my outcome worked out somewhat more positively than that guy, anyway.
I'd have to say so, yes.
But getting back to the gun thing and the blowing away of people possibility, I think on some level the one thing that kept me from literally and figuratively pulling the trigger was from an early age, from my, I don't know, maybe 10 years old, I wanted to get into radio, you know? I wanted to be a DJ, you know? And I held out some sort of hope that by the time I got old enough to do it, radio would still be a viable concern, and that somehow I would be able to actually do it. And as things turned out, off and on, between like 73 and 98, I made my living doing radio. I achieved some measure of my dream. Getting back to our current situation there on the horn, on the Kincaid homestead, I don't know what the boy's dream is, Bob. Only you know that. Maybe you don't know that. Maybe he's never expressed it. But there may be some benefit into finding out what that is and encouraging that and hoping like hell that some measure of it can be attained. Because a dream in the heart and soul of a young person can save you, literally, at least in my case, from horrible, horrible outcomes. And yes, you've got to get help if that sort of help is needed. Yes, you've got to do a lot of things that are necessary to get onto an even keel. But to me, I think the dreams of our youth should not be discounted. They should be encouraged, and they should be realizable. We're living in a world today where I wouldn't be a youngster today if I got $50,000 a year for doing it. My heart aches for the young people of America because so much has changed. So many doors have been slammed in their faces. There's no sense of possibility for a lot of these people, these young people. So that's my 2 cents worth for whatever it's worth, Bob.
Well, thank you, Scott.
Dreams will take you far. If you can get yourself on an even keel somehow and get the help that you need.
The without going into too much detail.
Yeah, and see, I was afraid that I didn't want to go down that path.
Yeah,
but anyway.
The problem arises in the fact that he is extremely bright and has a lot of talents, but I think his problems make it impossible for him to capitalize on them. And what this all centers on is the fact that his problem. Keeps him from being able to go forward, and it's been it has been a lifelong thing.
The boy could throw
a frozen rope baseball left-handed north of 50 miles an hour when he was 7 years old.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
That doesn't happen every day. He can play practically any. He can play practically any musical instrument that he hears. I mean, he plays keyboards and guitars just based on what he has heard. But whether it is because of environmental exposures in the womb, or because of things that he was exposed to later by people who shouldn't have gotten into his life, things have gone sideways. And he's got to have some sort of meaningful help. And what scares me to the toenails of my soul is that obtaining help on that level is something approaching almost impossible in a state like this. Add into it the fact that that the opportunities for his generation, you said you wouldn't be a kid right now for anywhere in this country for love nor money, and I agree. But some places in this country are worse than others. You know, for a long time I have said that young people in this state have more in common with young people in Gaza than they do with young people in other parts of this country. Because there is a sense of hopelessness that pervades this state. There is no work. There's no job that pays more than, very few jobs that pay more than minimum wage, and damn few that will pay minimum wage for 40 hours a week. The coal industry isn't even employing like it used to employ. I mean, this state is in a state of ongoing economic collapse, and it's being run by people who really don't care as long as their checks keep clearing. And that all may sound like excuse making, and it may be. But wait a minute. There we go. I lost you for a minute.
It may sound like excuse making.
It may be excuse making, but it's part of the whole thing. And there's the larger philosophical question of to what degree do we assign culpability or responsibility to people for their own for illnesses that are not necessarily of their choosing. I mean, do we blame people for getting the flu? I mean, if you know somebody's got the flu, and you go over and you waller all over them, and you smollock on them, and then you get the flu, that's kind of your fault. Or, yeah. You know, if a parent finds out that somebody down the street's kids have chicken pox, and he takes his own kids over there to make sure they get chicken pox, and that's Matt Bevin, the governor of Kentucky, that parent is, I would argue, criminally culpable in making sure, in having made his kids get chicken pox. But if you're wealthy, like Matt Bevin, nobody says anything to you.
Yeah.
And so we know a little bit about his disorder, and some may never have even yet been identified or diagnosed. And there's been no real effort to titrate him on a medication that makes sure that he, A, that it works, and B, that he takes it. Because, you know, full-grown adult, it's not like you can grind it up and put it in his food.
Yeah. Well, it will continue to be an intricate dance. You know, you think of the Arthur Murray Dance Academy with the outlines of the footprints on the dance floor where they're teaching you the cha-cha or the tango or whatever. There's a lot of goddamn outlines of feet required on the floor of life to do this dance.
Right, and unfortunately, sometimes there are just places where there aren't any outlines, and that's where we are.
Yeah. It defeats the purpose to want to have help, but there's no help to be had.
Well, we went looking for help, and we got retribution instead. And
yeah.
his mother is in agony over it. I'm in agony. I can't even begin to describe it. And this is talking about us, not him where he is. And it's soul destroying.
Well, like I said, earlier when I started down this road, when your heart's breaking, our heart is breaking. It's a collective thing. When your heart aches, ours aches. When you bleed and weep, we do too. Because we're in sync with you and Agnes and the family. Because that's how we are. It's not only how we are, it's who we are. You know?
Yeah.
And, you know, we have fun. Some of the most fun, humorous times I've had have been in conversation with you or with others on the front porch. It is a joyful experience. And this isn't that. There's no joy to be had in this. That's the thing. It is so frustrating. There don't seem to be solutions readily available, and there's certainly no joy in going through the process with you guys. But that's what we're up to,
And I don't know if he's doing it. I don't know if he has the ability to do it. But I can say without a doubt that his mother and I are sitting here constantly asking, you know, where was the wrong choice? What happened? If we had done X instead of Y or B instead of A. And that way lies madness.
Because you can't do that. You can only take what's been presented and dance with it as best you can. You know?
Yeah, and...
Because you will set yourself crazy trying to figure out, well, where did we
right,
go
and,
wrong?
And
maybe you didn't.
And in his case, it goes back to literally conception. I mean, he... the drugs that Agnes took with all three of the last three kids... And, you know, we were sitting there just ticking things off on our fingers. Every one of them has, and between that and living and gestating a baby in a toxic state. I mean,
yeah.
The place where we lived when she was pregnant with them is not technically the coal fields. Instead, there was 100 years of natural gas exploration there. We lived in a house once. We had this wonderful yellow Labrador retriever who was a puppy, and there was a big pond out in front of the house we were living in. And trying to keep a Labrador retriever out of water, you might just as well try to keep a fish out of it. And I remember the first time she saw that water, and we didn't think anything of it. She's a Labrador retriever. She's born knowing how to swim, and it wasn't that deep. And she bolted and jumped joyfully into that water, went for a swim, came out. We toweled her off, understand. And a couple of days later, all her hair fell out. She was the world's largest chihuahua because it was smack dab in the middle. It was smack dab in the middle of the natural gas fields. The water stunk of sulfur, it turned out. And I guess it was before. I can't remember. It was contemporaneous, probably. The pond was full of bullfrogs, And a buddy of mine was big into frog gigging, and I'll never turn down a plate of fried frog legs. They're tasty. So we gigged a bunch of frogs out of that pond and set to, you know, to clean them and dress them. And they smelled like gasoline.
Yeah.
It was awful.
I'm surprised there weren't like two-headed frogs or
and there are,
whatever.
You know, there are cancer clusters over in there. And at the time there was no so-called city water. Everybody had a well. Every well stunk of sulfur.
And that's just the way that it was. You know, people probably didn't think twice about it.
Well, it's always been that way for at least 100 years. I mean, we were living in a house that was built by one of the biggest rounders and bounders of the gas industry of the early 20th century. We didn't think anything about it. It was a charming little house. It was a charming big house.
Yeah.
With a lot of problems. Terrible heat. The whole area was interspersed with gas lines. And this is even before the fracking boom. And now the place...
Oh, yeah, because that has a...
You know, at one point in time, my grandchildren lived in a house that was triangulated by three fracking pads. And we've since found out that you know, those things emit toxins similar to the way that the blasting does from a mountaintop removal site.
Well, and the thing is, Bob, and you already know this, this is not a newsflash, but we human beings... And all creatures are intricate mechanisms, if you will. It's a delicate balance, wellness is. And we're only now really getting our heads around scientifically just what a delicate balance it is, not only in the world, the ecosystem, but in our own bodies and minds. And the balance can so easily be upset. And, you know, 20, 30,
well, you know, we talk 40, about frogs and bugs ago. We talk about frogs and bugs and beetles being marker species. Guess who else is a marker species? Yeah, humans.
Who?
Humans.
Yeah, well, yeah, obviously, yeah. And it's as if industry and government... that they're treating us like canaries in the coal, proverbial coal, canaries in the coal mine. And some of these agencies and industries have known for years what the maddening possibilities are. Yet, the fucking almighty dollar outweighs all that. Well, you know, you're always going to kill off a few people in progress. But you got to take care of that bottom line. Fuck them. Fuck them and their fucking bottom line. You know?
Yeah.
We weren't created to live like we currently live in modern society. It's frustrating as hell. And again, getting back to youth, I mean... 50 years ago, 60 years ago, even growing up as a child of the 60s, on some level I knew this, and there was seemingly more balance, and people were healthier in their outlook and in their opportunities and in their own bodies even. You look at pictures, group photos. I think somebody talked about this not long ago. You look at group photos of a typical group of Americans in the 60s versus a typical group of Americans today, nearly the second decade of the 21st century, and you almost don't believe it. People are all, you know, they look unwell, they're puffy or outright overweight.
Yeah.
All of us probably, I was talking to Tracy last night and complimenting her and applauding her on how well she's been doing with her program, and you know, just having to mention, all of us, every American really could probably stand to lose 20 to 30 pounds and be the better for it, you know? But anyway, Bob, I'm not going to belabor the point.
I understand.
Or delve any more deeply. But please know, and I'm sure I'm representative of the sentiment of the entire planetary Horn family. You know, we embrace you both and your son and your family from afar. And, you know, in those dark moments, you know, take some sort of comfort and solace in that knowledge. It'll be tempting not to, but, you know, please
no,
do.
No, believe you me, the outpouring of compassion and understanding that we've experienced here since last night's program has been monumentally uplifting. It absolutely
well,
has.
Well, good. Good.
And so consequently, I mean, it's just, and again, I feel kind of awful even talking about what it feels like on this end, because it's what's going on the other end that's driving me mad. I'm not accustomed to being utterly powerless, because it always seems like there's some action you can take, or there should be some action you can take.
Yeah.
And there's no action.
Well,
I mean, everything is a brick wall. Now, I tried to make one call today. I tried to make one call today and found out that this person of some rank that I was trying to reach apparently cannot be bothered to stay at work having arrived at 9, cannot be bothered to stay at work until 3.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm telling you, and it's as if, you know, as if the situation itself, the core level situation at ground zero of your life, it's as if that weren't bad enough to try to deal with. The people who are supposed to be available as resources don't. They don't seem to be in it for the right reason or something. I don't want to cast, you know, apply motives in a situation I know nothing about. But it seems to be a common thing in a lot of our world today where people just can't be bothered. And even people that are paid to be bothered. It's their fucking job description to be bothered. You know?
Yeah.
And I'm not telling you anything.
Well, no, the fact that, you know, the if you ask the scientists, they will tell you that there is, that some stress is good for you, some stress is bad. There's good stress and bad stress.
Yeah.
There's the stress that brings clarity. The stress that, hi, Clarity. The stress that focuses. And then there's the stress that just grinds and devours and consumes. This feels like the latter, not the former.
Yeah.
And I think maybe a different way to delineate that is to say that the difference is the stress where you are compelled to solve problems versus the stress that comes from being unable to address a problem. You know, the Marines famously are said to be that branch of the military where even the most low-level Marine has the latitude to do what is necessary to get the job done, where other branches might not. And so, the stress of that, Jesus. But, you know, Then there's just maybe the other way to describe that is just plain powerlessness.
And yeah, I've said for years, control is an illusion in some situations. There's, I mean, You know, and the funny thing is, and I don't mean to be the relentless optimist here, but I am speaking from some experience. Come December, it'll be 30 years ago that I had my close encounter with a walnut-sized tumor on my pituitary gland. And at the time, I thought, that's going to be the end of the world and the end of me. And I was in my mid-30s, I guess I was. Yeah, I was 35, because I'm 65 now. And I couldn't, I tried not to take a why me sort of approach to it, but you can't help but ask, why the fuck me? What was I doing? Bopping along, minding my own business, working radio on the weekends, selling cars during the week, more or less happily married, making decent money too, okay? Yeah, hardly a care in the world. And it's as if somebody hit the fucking pause button, you know?
Yeah, I remember reading somebody who had been through some sort of hellish situation, and having come through it, said, I will never ask why me again, because the real answer is, or the real question is not why me, why not me?
Yeah.
Out of all the billions on the planet, why not?
Here's your potential silver lining, if your life is anything like mine. Once I got over the initial shock and had had the surgery and had recuperated, you know, to the extent that that was possible, it ultimately dawned on me at some point not too far later on that maybe the whole purpose of the exercise was to get my attention. Not that there's anything inherently wrong with bopping along, but there were things about my personality and makeup that had I not had that opportunity to pause, I wouldn't have been in a space where I could have grasped and then addressed some of those issues in life. So in a real sense, it was as weird as it sounds, the whole experience was a gift, because it changed me. It gave me an opportunity for growth and transformation. And I know that it sounds Pollyannish, and that when you're in the midst of a hellish situation, the notion of a fucking silver lining or a good outcome or anything is hogwash. But if your experience and the family's experience is anything like mine, I can't help but hope for you and express for you the possibility that some good can come out of this. And it may not be a process that'll be easy, but you'll ultimately find, I think, that it's worth going through, as horrible as it could ever be.
Yeah, I don't think there's ever going to be one of those moments where we all look back on this and laugh.
Strangely enough, you will be surprised. Let me just put it that way. I don't want to predict anything, but at some point, Bob, I'm not going to relate the incident because it's going to ruin supper for everybody, you know.
Yeah, but let's take a break on the Pacific Daylight Time Zone this evening.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is there was a point where I had one of the best laughs of my life when I saw the cosmic gotcha that the universe was trying to convey to me, you know.
Yeah, no. I'm well versed in those moments. I will never forget, and I'm not making fun of anybody's disability. I will never forget the morning that my father died in my arms.
Mm-hmm.
And
you wouldn't tend to forget something like that, Bob.
And I laid him down on the bed, and I walked out to the nurse's station. He was in hospice.
Yeah.
And I looked at him and I said, "Well, he's gone." And, you know, trying to just maintain. So they called the funeral home to come and do what funeral homes do. Come and get the body. And I hope I never forget this. And I hope I never forget how I laughed. the guy came from the funeral home. And you have to understand that my father had had this operative philosophy through life. And he had learned to deal with just what life handed him. And Agnes and I were talking last night about our two respective families. And when you look back on it and you see what they lived through, Jesus Christ. So my father had this operating theory, and it goes along with things like buying a brand new car, leaving the next day for West Virginia, and having the gas tank fall off of it in Lawrenceburg, Tennessee, and discovering that the gas tank fell off because it had only been wired on with a coat hanger. Brand new car, Detroit fresh.
Jesus.
And
probably made on Monday.
Yeah,
they say never buy a car.
Yeah, that had to be a Monday car. His next car would lose its power steering whenever it drove through a puddle. Again, bought brand new off the lot. My father never bought a used car, and it was Detroit fresh.
And what time frame are we talking?
The one the gas tank fell off of was a 71 Chrysler Newport, and the one that lost its steering in puddles was a 74 Dodge Monaco Brome station wagon with a 400 cubic inch engine in it.
That was before the
Newport had a 383.
Wrong company and wrong slogan, but that obviously was before quality was job one.
Yeah, the quality just rode out of town. But he developed a theory over the course of his life. And then, of course, back before I was born, first couple of years of life, there was the Dodge station wagon that simply caught fire as he was driving it down the road. Looking back on that, I have no idea why he remained so steadfastly a Chrysler man. But he was.
Yeah.
And part of it was because he absolutely refused to purchase any product built by General Motors, because in 1948, when my father was a good union man, the president or CEO of General Motors had said that the average American working man was no better than a bird dog.
Yeah,
and he said it in public.
Yeah,
and my father was one to hold a grudge. There's a gas station, or there used to be. It's been torn down and had something else put up in its place. But right where, I guess it's New Circle Road in Lexington, Kentucky, right before you get on the Bluegrass Parkway, there was a gas station there, and the Bluegrass Parkway used to be a toll road. And if you got to the toll plaza and you didn't have change, you were fucked. Because it was all automated, and there was no person in the toll booth. And there was no, you know, the bill acceptors didn't exist at that time. So he pulled off at this one gas station to get nickels, dimes, and quarters for the toll booths. And they told him that if he did not buy something, that they would not give him change. And he said, well, that's well and good. I've bought gas here before in the past, but if you're going to be that way, be that way. And I will never set foot on this property again so long as I live. That happened in the 1960s. He died in 2007, and he kept his word to the end. And he cussed. And he cussed the place every time we drove by it, looking at my mother and saying, "Hey, Margaret, there's those son of a bitches that wouldn't give us coins, wouldn't make change." And so just to finish the story.
Yeah.
He had a theory, and he said, wherever there is a busted, broken down, malfunctioning, miserable piece of shit for sale, it is guaranteed that I will purchase it.
Yeah.
Kind of a grim outlook. But he did it. He did it with a chuckle in his voice. And so on that morning that the guy came from the funeral home, the final indignity for my father, they sent a guy who was the most cross-eyed human being I had ever seen in my life to pick up my father's last earthly remains. And it was, I mean, the day was hard enough as it was. But I took one laugh, and I had to run to the restroom. The staff thought I was going to have a good cry. But I got to the furthest restroom I could find and went into the furthest stall in the furthest restroom and looked up and said, "Jesus, Dad!" And started laughing and could not stop.
Yeah.
Because in that moment, I knew, I mean, I'm still not a religious man, and I'm not sure, I don't know what I feel about the afterlife, but I felt a sense of confidence that my father's spirit was lingering around there somewhere and said, and made somebody at the funeral home say, "No, send the cross-eyed guy."
Yeah, yeah.
Just for him. Or maybe, you know, up at the pearly gates, somebody said, he's on his way. "Oh, really? It's him? We'd have fucking with him for 82 years. Send the cross-eyed Undertaker."
Yeah, yeah. And you get to the great beyond, and there's a sign on the desk, "Correct change only."
Yeah, exactly.
That's about how it goes, yeah. Wasn't there a comic strip character? I think it was in Little Abner that had the cloud, the perpetual black cloud over his head.
Well, maybe it was, but, you know, I'm a little bit younger than you. I just remember a character in a later Hanna-Barbera iteration of the Flintstones where Pebbles and Bam Bam were teenagers, and they had a friend named Schleprock.
Yeah,
Who walked around with a lightning-filled hail and rain-filled cloud that just went everywhere over his head.
Yeah.
And I remember a guy in school once, nice guy, horrible luck, and he was simply referred to as Disco Dave and his cloud of doom, because wherever he went, the cloud of doom just persisted over his head. I gotta share a note with you, Scott, because Lady B sent you a note.
Oh, good. I love her.
And when Lady B sends you a note, you know you've arrived. Subject
line.
Well,
yeah, definitely.
Subject line: chicken salad out of chicken shit.
Yeah.
Thanks to Scott in San Diego for sharing such a deeply personal story. I never disliked him. However, I got to confess, sometimes I would hear his whimsical stories and think, he's the type of guy who likes to see the sunny side of life and everything. You know, the one who, when life hands you lemons, tells you to make lemon meringue pie or some shit. The type of person I resented the hell out of sometimes. After all, life sucks. Why can't people like him see that? But now, says Lady B, I understand. Now I know that we never really know the sacrifices our friends make just to tolerate us. For every person who gave up and tried to self-destruct, Scott was one who felt life was more precious than that. A person with a sense of purpose, the ability to see the glass as half full, is not a Pollyanna. They are actually quite powerful. Folks like that can help the rest of us through the darkness, but we have to let them. Thank you for not succumbing to the darkness, Scott. Thank you for believing there are more good humans than bad ones. Know that you are heard and loved. Thanks again for sharing your powerful story. Lady B.
Damn.
Shall I?
Lady B made me cry, Bob.
But in a good
that's
way.
A powerful woman. Yes, that's a powerful woman that bring tears to my eyes.
Well, I will copy and paste this into an email and send it to you so you can print it out and put it on your wall.
I don't have a printer, Bob. And I know I'm going to go in a few minutes here, not in a cosmic sense, But how, in response to Lady B, how do you think that I got to be the whimsical twerp that I am? You don't just wake up and become this. Okay? Even Church knows. She's seen the dark side. God knows. And Punky, too, back when he was around. But the point of it is, I came by this honestly. Where I currently am in life, there was a point where I too, would scoff at my attitude and my resiliency, you know, once upon a time. And you've got to go through just not to do a movie spoiler, but anyone who has seen the Shawshank Redemption film with Morgan Freeman and I forget the actor, real tall liberal actor who played
Tim
the
Robbins.
Lead role.
Tim Robbins.
Tim Robbins. Who, Andy Dufresne was his character. There is a point in the movie where he literally goes through shit. A tunnel of shit to reach a particular goal, okay? And you've got to do that in life. Sometimes you've got to go through the fucking tunnel of shit that's, you know, two football fields in length, you know? And I am the most fortunate bastard on the planet who's upright and above ground today. 7.5 billion people or something. And I am fortunate in that I have the hard-won capacity to have those moments where I fully get the joke. I get the cosmic whoopee cushion that has so consistently been slipped under my butt as I'm getting ready to sit down, you know, and can laugh and rejoice and celebrate it. And I wish that for everybody, Lady B. I hate to see people go through stuff, but the old Zen thing goes, the only way out is through. It took me years to get that. But once gotten, you can never unget it. And sure, I have shitty days from time to time. Everybody does. That's part of being, you know, a human being in the world. But by God, from brain tumor on, I wouldn't trade a moment of it, knowing now where it brought me.
Exactly. You know? And if you're lucky enough along the way to have, and you know, again, it's another one of those things that 200 years worth of dissertations have been written on. But, you know, Voltaire and Candide. And that relentless optimist walking around saying this is the best of all possible worlds. Or for me, the light bulb went on when I read as much of the Kurt Vonnegut canon as I could. And there's some dark shit in there. And some deeply blistering social commentary. But when he says that he looks around at the world he's in, and remember, this is a guy who walked from his captivity at the Battle of the Bulge to his captivity in a German Stalag to the point where he was one of few who survived the firebombing of Dresden, which had no military value whatsoever, and that everybody
yeah.
above ground was incinerated.
Yeah.
And he survived because he was hidden.
I've read those accounts.
Yeah, because he was hidden in an underground slaughterhouse, Schlachthaus 5. And with all of that, Kurt Vonnegut looks up and says, I look around and I ask myself, well, if this isn't nice, what is?
Yeah.
And he says that, he says toward the end of his life, and, you know, bless his heart, he tried to smoke himself to death.
Oh, those Paul Malls.
And he
those
just couldn't.
Red back Paul Malls.
He was not worth a tinker's damn at getting cancer. And so he winds up falling and busting his head and dies miserable that way. But this is the man who said
he tripped on the steps, stairs, didn't he?
Yeah. Kind of like, wasn't it William Holden that went the same way? But this is the guy who gave us
on the edge of a coffee table.
This is the guy who gave us If This Isn't Nice, What Is? Who also said toward the end of his life, I am more convinced than ever that we were put here to fart around, that we were put here to dance. And then sort of wrote his own epitaph describing what a glorious experience it was to have been allowed to become sitting up mud.
Yeah.
Mud that got to think. Mud that got to see. Mud that got to experience. And he did it all without a God.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, the contrary of that comes from Randy in PA, who says, you are a fluke of the universe. You have no right to be here.
For me?
No, Randy in PA. You are a fluke of the universe. You have no right to be here. And whether you believe it or not, the universe is laughing behind your back. National Lampoon.
Yeah.
That would probably be Douglas Kinney and Charles Beard.
Yeah, sounds about that, along that line. That's wasn't that the anti-desiderata that left '45?
Right, yeah, exactly.
I think they did a recorded version of that. I think you can find it on YouTube.
And I saw somewhere on social media today, Scott, a link to an Onion piece, and I'm still nerdy enough that I find the Onion to be hilarious. They're just having trouble with their material because they can't quite come up with anything as stupid and wacky and unbelievable as the reality in which we find ourselves living. But it was a piece from like 2016 or something. And the headline was FBI warns of Al-Qaeda plot to sit back, chill, and watch us collapse. And there were quotes in there from, made-up
quotes. They made up quotes from Ayman al-Zawahiri, who is a real person. And I think the Onion needs to be looked into for treason because the Al-Qaeda didn't really say that.
It quoted Ayman al-Zawahiri as saying, yes, from Pakistan to Yemen. To Algeria, from Somalia to Algeria, we have informed all of ourselves that they are to just chill, kick back, and laugh and watch as America's bridges crumble, as its roads turn to gravel, as its people get sicker without health care, and as its once for a mighty economy is reduced to nothing. And then it came back with something from the FBI agent saying, if they persist in this, we may all be doomed. And that was the laugh line because, the FBI guy is utterly oblivious to the fact that they're just kicking back and chilling while we do it to ourselves.
Yeah. Jeez. Well, Bob, I'm gonna. I bogarted the.
Well, and just one more thing. You got.
But I hope it was for good purpose.
It was, and you got fan mail from Jim.
Oh dear.
So, no, not oh dear, oh good. Jim.
Oh good. Okay. Jim, well, I'm so unused to fan mail.
Noting, I hear you, brother, because Jim has had his own journey down. A hellscape of a road and has still managed to figure out a way to laugh.
Yeah. It's a gift, I'm telling you.
Which, by the way, is the name which is the name of a hilarious, hilarious W.C. Fields film. Yes, it's a gift.
Is that
the one where the young starlet, I forget what her name was, Betty Jean or something, looks at him as he's drinking and says, Uncle, whatever, what are you drinking? And he does that double take where he kind of flinches and jumps, and he says,
Yeah.
Oh, it's,
It's nanny goat's milk. It's very sweet.
And there's a scene where he's falling through the air, and he's got the thermos with him, and he's trying to pour the nanny goat's milk while he's falling. Yeah.
It's very sweet.
God. Well, I will go, and I'll leave the Horn family and the universe with this message. In as much as you're able to do it, welcome adversity, because in it are the seeds of something that you would never expect. Let's just put it that way. And just know that I'm not the family spokesman here, but I've got the dog. Hello, so what's the fuss? I hope that it is endlessly conveyed to you and hits home at the darkest moment that we're with you, man, and we love you. So, I mean, the same goes for Agnes and the rest of the family. So, and Lady V, you made my day. I look forward to getting that thing. So if and when I do get a printer, I can print it out and frame it and have a talented seamstress do a cross stitch or needle point.
Now, there
or whatever,
you, okay, now you're
have
talking.
A pillow.
Now you're talking.
Yeah.
I'd go for cross stitch and frame it and hang it on the wall. Like maybe where you see it every night before you go to sleep and every morning when you awake.
One last thing, and it's quick. There's, back in the early 70s, I learned of the presence on the planet of a cartoonist out here in Santa Barbara by the name of Ashley Brilliant. He has a collection of over 10,000 pot shots. These are mailable postcards, U.S. postcards, with little rudimentary artwork and witty sayings. And one of my favorite pot shots, this may be my epitaph, if I can get them to chisel it onto the stone. Due to circumstances beyond my control, I am master of my fate and captain of my soul. And I took that to heart.
That's pretty damn brilliant.
Well, and his legal name is Ashley Brilliant, so you do the math.
True. Going back to Vonnegut, I've always been fond of the words of Malachi Constant. Upon exiting the spaceship from Mercury, who emerged and declared, "I am a victim of a series of accidents, as are we all."
There you go. There you go. All right, Bob. Take care. Be well. Be happy as you can. And keep on keeping on.
All right, you too. Take care, Scott.
Okay, see ya.
Thank you. Thank you for your kind words. Bye now.
You're more than welcome. See ya.
Later. And going back down the email chain for just a moment to James in Illinois. Subject line, fuck Chrysler products. I've owned three of them. Each had its own story. All were lemons to varying degrees. Three strikes, they're out. And I followed in my father's footsteps to a certain extent. I bought the big rusty red pickup truck in 1995. It served us well, but along the way, it did develop a problem with the fuel pump. And in a moment of pure engineering genius, instead of having a fuel filter that was in the fuel line where you just pop the line, you change the filter, the filter itself was attached sort of like the mantle on a Coleman lamp to the fuel pump itself down in the bowels of the gas tank. And so when that thing got clogged, you were screwed. And on the rusty red pickup truck, it manifested itself by fuel starving, preferably with a semi going 75 miles an hour bearing down on us in a part of the West Virginia Turnpike where there was no median, only guardrail. That actually happened. I was taking Agnes to the doctor, and it started... and the semi was bearing down, and I hit the I hit the flashers and started tapping my brakes, hoping the semi would have the common sense to go, you know, get out and go around. And he did, because we're here. But for a minute there, I looked at her and said, "Just in case, dear, I've been very happy. I've loved you every minute of the way." And I don't do that very often, and she knew I was serious. Yeah, Richard in the chat room says, "You had to drop the entire gas tank to change the filter." Well, you couldn't just change the filter. You had to change the whole fuel pump. And apparently that was a thing that caught on with Chrysler, because it also happened to us in a Dodge Durango, and it happened to us in an Eagle Vision sedan. Every one of them it happened to. Because the thing was so far down, you know, the way that gasoline is formulated now, it was so far down in the gas tank, because the fuel pump has to be able to get to the last of the gas, that the thing would suck up all the detritus and varnish, and was predestined to clog, and replacing the damn thing was every bit of $300, and it happened 3 times. And that is why I am presently in a Ford. So there's that. But the sad thing is, we've gone far afield. I saw photos of the 2020 Dodge Barracuda. I wish they wouldn't do this to me. 5.7-liter V8 gas-guzzling Hemi. Jesus. And the design, that was always the thing. Chrysler was good with design. They made beautiful-looking automobiles. It's just that they weren't so good at being beautiful-going automobiles. So I don't know how that became a thing. Richard pointing out, yeah, but I actually had 3 excellent Chrysler cars. You had to get them from good years. Yeah, but it's not like French wine where you've got people you can count on saying, "Oh no, these are good ones." So we've got just a little bit less than a half hour remaining in the program. If you want to get in on the conversation, funny, Driven Slush in the chat room says, "So there were 3 good years, 3 cars, 3 good years." Yeah, that's about how it works. Now, the rusty red pickup truck turned out to be magnificent, and I would be remiss if I did not say that on the 31st day of December 2011, back, you know, climate change, Chinese hoax, on the 31st day of December 2011, when it was 72 degrees outside, my wife, at the insistence of my son, had driven him downtown to get a pair of gloves, for he was going skiing and could not wait until I got home to go. And so he badgered his mother into taking him down, getting him a pair of gloves. She did, and was stopped getting ready to turn left onto our little road when one of the local pill heads rear-ended them and hit them in a Toyota RAV4 so hard that it drove the bed up into the cab of the rusty red pickup truck and bent the frame so badly that it was that you could look and see the curve in the frame. It gave my son and my wife both a concussion. They both had their seatbelts on, but they still got smacked. But that truck saved their lives. So, lest anyone think that it was it had 130,000 miles on it, and except for the fuel filter problem, it was a mighty fine truck. So, let's see who we've got on the stress line there. And among other things, just a reminder as we move toward the close of the program, Tracy's In Case of Emergency Meat Challenge was met. And that means that we've only got $95 to go to finish with the evening's regular fundraising. And it would be great if we could finish that off. Hey, welcome to the program. Oh, wrong button.
Over here.
Hello, there you are.
Hey, Bob. The goddess of irony holds us all in her loving hand, Bob.
Yes, she does. This day?
I'm not reporting from the blind today.
No?
I'm on the island of sanity, puppy sitting.
Ah, well, okay, a noble undertaking.
Well, Christine got a second pit bull puppy.
Oh.
Sweetie's litter mate, Freddie. And the funniest thing is watching these two play, because Sweetie will get under Freddie and then stand up real quick and he'll stumble. And I guess it passes for what happens with a dog joke. But, it's been interesting. Last night was the anniversary of the fire. You might recall I got burned out 2 years ago.
Yes, I do.
That's a hell of an infamous date.
I need to write that down, the second day of October, Dave. You get burned out, Tom Petty dies, and Jamal Khashoggi gets chopped into chutney by our partner in peace, Mohammed bin Bonesaw.
Well, speaking of Mohammed bin Bonesaw, I heard something that a Australian army band did when he had a state visit. They played the Vader March.
Oh, God, I would love to know that that's absolutely true.
and, of course, he didn't get the reference. Right.
Of course, but yeah, because he's just a clueless little fossil fuel hydrocarbon punk with a bunch of money.
But the beauty of it is, Bob, every Australian official that was there was rather uncomfortable because they got it.
Well, that's the thing, and you know what? You'd be uncomfortable too. I mean, you got a guy who orders people to be murdered and dismembered. Whilst still alive with a goddamn bone saw, yeah, I'd be a little nervous too.
Well, here's the beauty of it, and it's good to hear from Crocodile Kincaid.
Well, thank you.
Every once in a while, but
we have to cite Ron and Raleigh for that shtick. That belongs to him.
I heard about Bernie suspending his campaign,
yeah,
because of his health issues.
I wish him well. Yeah, and I'm glad you brought that up because I want to make mention of something. Remind me, but you go ahead.
My question is the always burners, you know, who ended up voting for Trump or Jilly Jill Jill or whatever. Do you think they're going to sit out the election because their man?
Right now they're not. He's not out of the race.
He's just suspended the campaign.
He has suspended until such time. You know, he pulled his Iowa ads, and he's suspended until such time as he gets. Until he gets the medical go ahead to get back busy. I mean, stenting is, as compared to, say, getting one's chest cracked, a much less insulting.
Invasive.
It's much less invasive, and it's much less of a surgical insult. It's literally a matter of cutting a hole into the artery in your arm or your groin, and you go up and you take the little camera and you look around, you find the blockage, you take the stent's unexpanded, it's got a balloon inside of it. You go up into the blockage and you blow up the balloon. The stent expands. The artery's opened up, and I mean you're not even unconscious for the procedure. But you have to lay really still for like 12 hours. You can't move because you've got to give the.
Oh, that's got to be hell, especially for a guy like Bernie.
You've got to give the artery a chance to close up. Now that may have changed some because Cleveland Clinic pioneered a technique. Whereby they came up with some sort of a plug, so the time flat on your back not moving was reduced. But I'm glad you brought up, and I wish nothing but the best for Bernie.
I voted for the guy in the.
I voted for him in my primary in West Virginia in 2016. And I was proud to do
you
it.
You know?
But in the course of
I've
a conversation.
Got a lot of love for Bernie.
There was a conversation between Ali Velshi over on MSNBC and their chief medical correspondent or whatever he is, Dr.
Financial correspondent.
No, their medical correspondent. I think his last name's Turner or something. I don't know. Doesn't really matter.
Okay.
And he was laying out what I just did. I'm repeating what he repeated. But I also have real-world experience with my dad to know that what he was saying was correct. But then he said, they're telling Bernie that he might get out Sunday. And he said, ordinarily, most people who have a stenting procedure are out a lot sooner than that. Okay.
Yeah, but isn't he like 87 years old or something like that?
No, he's 78. Nice try, but backwards.
Oh, okay.
He's 78.
No,
I got it
backwards.
But what grabbed me, Dave, is he said, well, you know, most people are out a lot sooner than that, and you can be back to work in no time flat. And he said, but they'll probably keep him a little bit longer because nobody wants to be the doctor. And he said, you know, Bernie's a very high-profile figure. And nobody wants to be the doctor who released him and then something unfortunate happened. And
yeah, they want to be extra careful with him.
Yeah, but in that moment, and you know, bless Bernie's heart, Bernie has talked about the fact that, hey, I could get this badly needed procedure. How many Americans couldn't? All right?
I think he's going to go for that Medicaid for all thing full force now.
Yeah, and he's absolutely right in that regard. And anybody who does any of these candidates who do not have a plan that guarantees that every American can get access to life-saving health care. I don't give a shit about insurance. Go see the doctor. You know, there's not an insurance executive in this country who could close a fucking wound with a stitch. There's not an insurance executive in this country who could prescribe a medication. They're drones. They're useless. They're a drag on the culture and a drag on the healthcare system, these healthcare executives. But to get back to what the doc said, nobody wants to be the guy who releases somebody like that who's famous and high profile, and then something bad happens. And when your mind works like mine, Dave, it's not just that I heard the guy say that, I heard the opposite of what he said. Because anytime somebody says something, makes a statement like that, it also encompasses and encapsulates and contains its own opposite. Because
its own destruction.
Because the opposite of what that expert doc said was that in America, people who have just ordinary people who have stenting procedures because they have insurance, well, the insurance company wants them out of the goddamned hospital and off the bill as quickly as they can get them. And so you don't want to be the doctor who turns out Bernie Sanders too early and something bad happens, but it's okay if you're the doctor who turns out ordinary, average American Joe and something bad happens. I mean, it's regrettable, but, you know, really, he wasn't, Joe wasn't important to the well-being of the country. And that little moment just crawled all over me like bed bugs from a Trump hotel.
because it was an
admission, Dave, that the care that even insured people get in this country is often substandard and is often driven by financial concerns and not concerns over what is adequate health care or, in fact, what the standard of care is.
What was it I saw on a program about the British Health Service, the National Health Service in Britain? Somebody asked a Londoner how they felt about their medical bill, and these people looked at them and go, "What bill? Are you out of your mind?"
But I have a feeling.
If I'm sick, I go to the doctor.
Yeah, I have a feeling that if Bernie heard that passage, he'd probably be outraged too, because it meant it was an admission on that doctor's part that
they're in it for the profit.
Well, that doctors aren't really motivated by patient well-being, but rather
they're employees of the insurance company.
Well, yeah, or that you know, every patient they have to care for an extra day is one less procedure they can be doing.
I'm very fortunate in that, you know, as I said, a couple of weeks ago, I had to check myself into the hospital. And this has happened a couple of times with me. And having lived with Christine and lived through her thinking she was back at Fort Jackson, and she was on the seventh floor of a building, and she thought her bunk was out the window, and I had to talk her out of it and fool her into thinking that I was taking her to the base hospital. When in our early days, that things have improved as far as the care, but I'm dreading the $4,000 bill for the hospital stay, because I was there for 2.5 days. And it would make a hell of a lot more sense if you treated physical health the same, or mental health, the way you treat physical health. Like you said, you don't yell at somebody for having the flu, but if you have major depression or schizophrenia or any of those, there's the instance, oh, it's a failure on your part, and it's not. It's not a failure on the person who has its fault. I have mental illness that runs, well, no, it doesn't actually run. It flies through both sides of my family.
Well,
and
that's kind of the way, you know, alcoholism doesn't walk or crawl through hours, it gallops. And so one has to be extremely careful.
And my sister had to remind me when I called her that my mother was not a well woman mentally toward the end of her life. And she never really had been. And I never thought about it. My grandfather on my father's side was a schizophrenic. You were asking, you know, you ask yourself a question in your case about what did we do wrong? Chances are it wasn't anything you did or didn't do.
And that is
There's a large biological component.
Yeah, sure, and a genetic component. But the other part of it is that while one may rationally admit that, it doesn't stop the questions from bedeviling.
And it
one.
Doesn't stop the pain.
Right.
But my advice to you is, if you're feeling that way, go ahead and feel that way. Don't fight it, because if you fight it, you don't work your way to where you can adjust to it. I mean, I'm never going to be a well man mentally. I know this.
You seem to hold it pretty well together in our calls. So, you know, there's that.
Well, yeah, but you haven't heard me when I hear one of these right wing Trump pansies in one of your clips, and I'm going, "God damn, brother!" You know, and I would, I get so irritated with them because, you know, they're morally right, and those of us on the more progressive end of the things that want to see people cared for are somehow evil and nasty. And that's coming from corporate America. I worked for a division of Citigroup in my younger year, you know, 15 years ago. And the way you would hear these people talk about finance, we would try to help people, manage their debt and get out of it and have something. But at times we were at war with other divisions of Citigroup. At the time, Citigroup owned Travelers Insurance. Well, I was a life insurance agent, and the whole life policies that they were selling at Travelers, we weren't. And we were telling people to stay away from them. Eventually, Citigroup spun off the company I was with. But you would have these guys who would go, well, Republicans have better ideas about this than Democrats. And I'm thinking, no, because if you took away the necessity for a company to pay for health insurance and everybody was covered, and I could go, if I was having a problem with my depression, I could go and see a doctor to get my antidepressants. I mean, I see a psychologist every other week, and have been working with him for the last 7 years. And I don't trust doctors or mental health professionals. This is something you're going to deal with FERC, possibly, is that he may not trust them. And just keep the line of communication open with him. He might not want to communicate with you, but you and Agnes keep it open with him. Because sometime, at some point, he's going to need to reach out to you. I mean, yeah, he's probably pretty pissed off at you right now. But you've been put in an untenable situation. And I'm telling you from experience. I'm not blowing smoke up your ass here. Anything like that, just understand that his perception is going to be far different than what yours is or what Agnes's is.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And it can adjust.
Well, there's just so much. There's so much. I mean, and time.
I know.
And time has to pass, Dave, but I thank you very kindly. I think I'm going to try to wrap things up here, my friend. I really appreciate the kind words, the advice, and the guidance.
Well, just remember, comedy has the Latin root commodus, where we get the toilet from.
I gotta. Nah, you're going to make me look that up. Oh, I hear the
well,
puppy.
Well, am I wrong?
Well, I don't.
Am I wrong?
I don't know. I mean, there's. Does that mean the guy who, the emperor who followed Marcus Aurelius would be known in English as the Emperor Toilet?
Yes.
But then there's
Commodus.
Also but then there's also accommodate.
Actually, it means comfort in Latin.
Yeah, okay.
Commodus means comfort in Latin.
I didn't have a brain cell with that on it, at least not immediately to hand. Dave, have a great evening.
But
pet the puppies for
us. I will,
us.
Bob. You take care of yourself. I will. And the beloved Christine just walked in. That's why they were barking.
Ah, wonderful.
So,
well, my best to the beloved Christine, please.
All right.
You take care.
Good night, Bob.
Bye, Dave. Our buddy Dave, not reporting from the blind. Great observation from Randy in PA. The key word where it involves mental health in the insurance industry is parity with physical health. We had parity for a brief period of time in the U.S. I don't know if we still have it. Just based on what we're observing, that would be a no. And once again, you can never tell what's going to capture the imagination of this community. Apparently, the Chrysler discussion did. Brother Deacon Asa says, I don't want to pile on, but there's a reason they say get out of Dodge. I had a Dodge Caravan with 30,000 miles on it. Some bitch acted like a horse and carriage when shifting between gears. I kept taking it back to the dealer, where they told me, with a straight face, mind you, that I ain't driving it right. The text, I added the accent, but the grammar was entirely Asa's. The text said, you got to drive it like it's stolen. I said, I have two other cars, one a Ford, another a Nissan, and I don't seem to be driving them wrong. Asa observes, bunch of assholes, as the dude would say. Oh, a dude reference. Cool. And Darlene had asked a question, saying that, and if anybody wants to chime in post-show, it's welcome. Darlene asked a question saying, dang, any opinions on the Chrysler Pacifica? I'm getting scared off them now. I test drove one a few years ago, as they have stow-and-go flooring, which they just remove and do some minor modifications to make it power wheelchair accessible. No major restructuring of the frame necessary, which is why it was my first choice. Darlene, I hate to break it to you. I put the question to Brother Deacon Asa, and Asa's the only input I have so far. Well, just like you said, they're designed to look great, but routinely unreliable. Pacifica is practically Fiat. On the other hand, Brother Deacon Asa adds, I'm going to pick up my Ram 1500 from the mechanic this evening with a $1,700 bill awaiting me. Front and rear suspension was shot, and somehow the rotors like to dissolve in a relatively short period. To their credit, the suspension was probably due. Truck has 100,000 miles on it. You got a Chrysler product to 100,000 miles. Somebody get, you know, Chrysler should give out the badges like Mercedes-Benz does. James in Illinois, with his Chrysler story, says, and I guess we can write off getting Fiat Chrysler as a sponsor of the program. The last one was the worst. Mid-90s Dodge Intrepid. Beautiful car. Yeah, they were. That was when Chrysler invented that cab forward design. They were lovely. That's what the Eagle Vision was. Cab forward, same thing as an Intrepid. Beautiful car. Do not ever drive through standing water in one. I'm not talking mid-door. Oh, no. Just up to the undercarriage. The geniuses at Chrysler decided that the air intake is down there. So if you drive through about 7 or 8 inches of water, it sucks into the engine, and the engine then is no more. I have driven my old Ford pickup through water that did come up around the door. It was scary. You can't stop because that'll suck water into the exhaust. But the good old truck, the good old Ford truck, got us through. Well, James, if it's any consolation, it was 2017. We were in New Orleans, and I'd gotten the call to go on All In with Chris Hayes to talk about the opioid crisis in West Virginia. And usually when I get the call, I'm up here, and they say, do we need to send a car? And I'm like, no, you'll never find me. And so I say, no, I'll just drive on down. And I go down to the mountain to Charleston and all, and whatever. Good times had by all. But they sent a car for me in New Orleans. And the day before, they had had that flood that happened it was just an August thunderstorm in New Orleans, and those things are epic, and New Orleans is mostly below sea level. And so the pumps failed. And so New Orleans flooded fairly epically for such a blasé thunderstorm. Well, they sent a 7 Series BMW limo to pick me up, which was kind of ritzy, if you want to get right down. I mean, I was impressed. But the driver told me, I said, nice car. He said, yeah, we're not buying anymore. We'll find something else. This is, he said, we got four of these, and three of them aren't running yesterday. Aren't running because of yesterday or since yesterday. I said, what? It's a BMW. He said, yeah, but BMWs for the European market have the air intakes up top. But for some reason or another, the BMWs for the American market have the air intakes down below. And when it flooded yesterday, three out of four of our BMW 7 Series sedans sucked water into the engines, and they're not cars anymore. They're paperweights. That's a BMW, James. I don't know. Maybe the guy left Chrysler in the mid-90s and went to work for BMW. Oh, Jesus. So, that. Thanks for the heads up, Randy and PA. Lee in New York, obligatory married with children reference. Dodge offered Al Bundy an award to watch his odometer go back to all zeros. Oh, I seem to remember that. That's good. So, it's a little community-made miracle. We've gotten. You've helped me get through 3 hours of radio. And I tell you, the honest to goodness of it is, I was looking forward to these 3 hours. I always look forward to these 3 hours. Sometimes it's harder than others. Sometimes I'm more tired. But the last couple of days, these 3 hours have been something approaching salvation. So thank you. We'll pick up tomorrow, Friday, on the front porch. Goddamn stink bugs. I hate the little bastards. I mean, they're more prevalent in Appalachia right now than bed bugs at a Trump hotel. We'll start tomorrow with a fresh challenge from Tracy in case of emergency. Meet Tracy's challenge. And we'll have a total of $295 to try to raise. Thank you. Thank you very kindly for meeting Tracy's challenge this evening. Thank you to Jan and Jerry. And thank you very kindly to Renee. And thank you to Libby. It's not $295, it's $280. I'm sorry. We got $80 to go to finish the evening. Thank you, Libby. Thank you to Jan. And thank you to Renee. And I feel like I'm... yeah, there we go. Yeah, Jan, Libby, Renee. And I'm missing one more. I'm sorry, my mind is just kind of... But at any rate, I think I thanked everybody along the way, and thank all of you for being part of this community. Thank you so very much for sharing your precious finite time engaging in this conversation. Thank you to our all-volunteer staff. Thanks to Steve and Sparky earlier in the chat room. Thank you to our news ninjas. Thank you, Brother Deacon Asa, headon.live. Thank you, John Fox in Australia. Thank you, Ben Birch, whiterosesociety.org. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, 20 years at the forefront of the struggle for human rights and environmental justice in Appalachia. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. And I love you, son. Later.